This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are here to discuss this past week's important news with our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Conditions in Venezuela are terrible right now under the rule of Nicolas Maduro. The United States has supported a change in government. This week, though, that effort was forcibly challenged by Russia. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on March 23rd, two Russian Air Force planes arrived in Venezuela's capital, and they were carrying almost 100 soldiers and more than 38 tons of military equipment, and also the chief of staff of Russia's ground forces. So this is a small but still a very meaningful Russian force. And as you said, they're there to support the Venezuelan dictator, Nicolas Maduro. It was about 6 years ago now that Maduro came into power. And under his leadership, Venezuela has suffered its worst ever economic crisis. Hyperinflation has rendered the currency virtually worthless. There's chaos in the streets. Basic goods, you know, foodstuffs and medicine have all but vanished from stores for the most part. And more than 3 million people, which is about 7% of the total Venezuelan population, have fled the country, mostly on foot. So it's a serious crisis that just keeps getting worse. But then in January, on top of all that economic and political chaos, Maduro rigged an election that gave himself another term. And this was kind of a final straw for a lot of the people of Venezuela, and tens of thousands of them took to the streets to protest it. And a man named Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, he declared himself interim president, and he said, "I'll be president temporarily until we can hold free and fair elections and elect a legitimate one." And most countries agreed with Guaido. The U.S., Canada, most nations of Europe, and most of Venezuela's neighbors there in Latin America, they all declared support for Guaido, and they called on Maduro to step down. But Russia and China, you know, they've continued to support Maduro, and Maduro still has the support of the Venezuelan military as well. So he's been able to cling to power despite pressure from the U.S. and these other nations. U.S. President Donald Trump has said that all options are on the table for America ousting Maduro. Up until this point, he's, you know, mostly relied on diplomatic and economic kinds of pressure, but he has said that all options are on the table, which means that military options would be included. But Russia is dead set against anything like that. The Russians have said that they would block any attempts at a kind of a military coup orchestrated by an outside power. And now with this Russian force on the ground, the Russians are really positioned to make good on that pledge to prevent any kind of an ouster like that. And it's not that the U.S. couldn't easily overcome a Russian force of this size, even if it were combined with Venezuela's full military. But since Russia is involved, it would be far more complicated for the U.S. to get involved, just because it could spark kind of a proxy war with Russia, the kinds of things that we've seen play out, you know, over the decades in several nations where proxy wars have erupted.
Although it's hard to imagine. Well, I guess I'd be interested to just talk about what Russia is trying to accomplish here, other than just poking Donald Trump in the eye. It seems like it definitely is calling Donald Trump's bluff in some ways, and stepping in and kind of daring the United States to actually back up those words.
Well, yes, I think that's. That's probably accurate. You know, Russia has been a stalwart supporter of Maduro since the beginning of his leadership back in 2013. Russia has invested billions of dollars into Venezuela during that time in military contracts and related projects.
If Maduro is ousted, that jeopardizes Russia's investments.
Well, it does, but the thing is, you know, Maduro is presiding over a failed state at this point. So I think that Moscow, they do have a vested interest, but at this point, they know that they're unlikely to get any return on those investments, any kind of long-term return. So I think that the true motive for Vladimir Putin in Russia is basically what Russian and before them Soviet leaders have sought for so long, and they've always relished, which is challenging American authority in its own backyard. You know, I think that's the real goal here, is just to challenge America's influence and to work toward establishing a real Russian military presence right there in the U.S. periphery. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really tragic that the people of Venezuela, for Putin, are just viewed as collateral damage.
Right.
You know, if Putin had any concern for the millions of people living there who don't want to be under Maduro's terrible leadership and who are suffering so much as a result of it, if he had any concern for them, he would say, let's get this guy out of here and let the people vote in a leader who can stabilize things a little bit. But Russia's only concern is for itself and its power. And if millions of people have to suffer and be malnourished and displaced and homeless in order for Russia to have slightly more power in some faraway pocket of the world, then that's what will happen.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent bottom line type analysis. Looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, obviously we would be interested in seeing how the United States, how the Trump administration responds to what Russia has done. And as you said, if the United States really wanted to deal with a force the size of the one that Russia actually put on the ground in Venezuela, would not be that difficult. But the idea of the United States actually committing its military to deal with this situation, in some ways it's hard to foresee, and you have to think that Putin recognizes that. How do you see this playing out?
Well, on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did make a phone call to Russia. He spoke with the foreign minister there, and he said the U.S. would not stand idly by as Russia backed Maduro. But for several years now, the U.S. has basically reversed course on the Monroe Doctrine. Mm-hmm. That was the policy originated by President Monroe back in the 1820s. And it basically said the U.S. would not tolerate foreign powers meddling in the Americas. And the U.S. used to enforce that and to protect its interests in the region. But under the Obama administration, especially, Washington proclaimed that the era of the Monroe Doctrine is over. You know, President Obama was ashamed of America's history. Mm-hmm. He was contemptuous of everything that we've done everywhere around the world, really. So he wanted to bring an end to the time when America would prevent communist takeovers in places like Grenada. And now President Trump, for different reasons, is also in favor of being, you know, the U.S. being less of a global policeman. For President Trump, it's more about the financial costs of those kinds of activities. But beyond that, and beyond any specific president, we also know that the U.S. has not really won a war since World War II. It's been afraid to really use its power ever since then. And that's the result of the nation's sins, which is explained in Leviticus 26. That chapter says God would break the pride of the nation's power if they rejected him, which is exactly what's happened. So even if Pompeo's words are backed by some kind of action, which could be the case, even if America does decide to challenge this new Russian influence to a degree, it's unlikely to be the kind of challenge, I think, that's forceful enough and bold enough to really bring quick stability to this situation.
Mm-hmm. So looking at it from the prophetic standpoint, in the long run, we talk about some sort of besiegement happening against the United States. Maybe you could just talk about that.
Sure, yes. Bible prophecy talks about a time in the future when the U.S. will be besieged. That's in Deuteronomy 28:52. It says it'll be besieged in all its gates. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, quite a lot about this besiegement and how it will happen at the hands of a European power in conjunction with Russia and China. So Mr. Fleury has pointed to prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 that talk about a mart of nations really orchestrating this besiegement. And these are describing cooperation between Europe and Russia and China. And it shows that they'll operate in a way that will kind of block the U.S. out of world trade and eventually even besiege them. So to see Russia right now getting more and more of a foothold, even a military foothold right there in Venezuela, just across the Caribbean from from the United States, it's easy to see how the, you know, it's kind of creating the conditions for that prophesied siege to take place.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk more about the Chinese and European aspects of that alliance later on in the program. In the meantime, do go to thetrumpet.com and you can read an article that Jeremiah has written on this subject. Russia sends troops to Venezuela in upset to possible intervention. That's on thetrumpet.com. And he also links to an article that we wrote a little bit earlier that gives more information and more context about that prophecy of the Mart of Nations, preparing to storm America's castle. We'll put links to both of those articles in the show notes for today's program. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Violence between Israel and Gaza escalated this week, sparked by a rocket launched at Tel Aviv on Monday. The conflict has brought a little herd of Palestinian political faction into the spotlight. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was another significant uptick of violence this week, starting on Monday morning when this rather large rocket was fired from the northern Gaza Strip, and it flew 110 kilometers, quite far over the top of Tel Aviv and into a township just north of Mishmeret, and it hit a house directly. There's aerial footage of this, of the house, and it's very much destroyed. Seven people were injured. Nobody was killed, amazingly. And really, this was quite an escalation in the type of weaponry that is used from the Gaza Strip. Normally, we talk about the weapons that it, the missiles, the rockets, and the mortars that are fired, and they land within about 10 kilometers of the Gaza border. Here's one that traveled a full 110 kilometers and hit its target. And so in the time since Tuesday and Wednesday, there was another 60 mortars and rockets, smaller ones that were fired from the Gaza Strip, and Israel responded forcefully with airstrikes again in the Gaza Strip. And this is interesting again because we have, well, let's just, first of all, this is war between two states. We kind of forget that, and well, two peoples in a way, because it happens so regularly. But what we've seen over the past 6 months is this sort of situation where you have this lone rocket or missile that flies a large distance. There was earlier in the month, there was a couple that flew over Tel Aviv that were shot out of the sky. And then following that, you have retaliatory strikes from Israel. And then you have a back and forth for a little bit. Going back to the end of last year, in November, you had the same type of thing, massive new style weapon fired from the Gaza Strip, hits Ashdod, destroys an apartment building. That's the one I actually got to visit. Then back in October last year, you have another massive rocket that flies over to Beersheba, 40 kilometers away, destroys a house. And then you have the back and forth that follows. And what's being revealed by each one of these initial rockets or missiles that's fired is that it is being directly ordered by Iran. Directly ordered by Iran, and not using necessarily the Palestinian faction of Hamas, but Palestinian Islamic Jihad, another terrorist group that operates out of the Gaza Strip, that is fully in bed with Iran in terms of decision making, money, even more so than Hamas. And so it seems like right now, all the instigation of a lot of the violence is being headed by this Palestinian Islamic Jihad group, and it's being directed directly by Iran.
Now, it's interesting, say, with this last round of violence, it seems Hamas very quickly tried to distance itself from that, and it seems they are eager to try to preserve a negotiation path with Israel. This other group that you're describing, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, has no such interest, and they've been much more belligerent and openly hostile against Israel.
Yeah, well, you've got this interesting situation. Islamic Jihad, they're not a new group. They've been around for a decade, but they have been working in conjunction with Hamas for that time period. I mean, they both work together. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad leadership often gets a lot of perks from Hamas because it's this other group that has similar goals and that is ready to put their lives on the line. However, as time's gone on, especially over the past year, Hamas is suffering, its leadership is suffering inside the Gaza Strip because it's been cut off by resources by the Palestinian Authority, by Fatah, and by Israel. Israel is not allowing the transfer of money from Qatar anymore to come in and pay for Hamas's salaries and such. And so they're hurting. They want to have, it seems, some type of ceasefire right now with Israel. Right now, today, there are Egyptian mediators that are going back and forth between Israel and Hamas to try and stop any further spiraling out of control of violence on the border. And yet, here you have this Iranian-backed group that says, we want violence. We want to continue to push against Israel. There's thoughts, people writing how that Iran doesn't want Netanyahu to be reelected, and so they're trying to force a war before the elections next in a week and a half, which would not help Netanyahu win a victory. And so they are continuing to ignite the fire between Israel and Hamas. And Hamas doesn't really know what to do, because it seems like it doesn't have as much control as it did inside the Gaza Strip.
Quite a lot in recent months about just how much Iran seems intent on escalating its war against Israel. It has a lot of different tools and weapons that it can use, because it's got these relationships with so many different jihadist groups in the region. And here it seems as though one of them is becoming a little bit not less pliant in Israel's hands, and so Iran's hands, excuse me, and so Iran just turns to another one.
Yeah, they've got lots of tools, as you say, and this situation that we have developing in the Gaza Strip, I definitely don't want people to believe that, you know, Hamas is all for peace with Israel. That is not their goal at all, and they still align themselves with Iran. In many ways, but Bible prophecy is very interesting in how it talks about this territory of the Gaza Strip, and this is the territory that the Philistines used to occupy during biblical times. And we often talk about how Iranian-led jihadis with Hamas are going to be aligned, or Iran is going to lead Hamas in many ways, as well as other Palestinian factions, to make a play on Jerusalem. But the Bible also reveals that there is going to be a point at which those Palestinians in this territory that Hamas dominates, they're actually going to be a part of another biblical alliance, in the Psalm 83 alliance. And so it seems like we have this kind of relationship happening right now, how you have Hamas that is sometimes allied with Iran and a Hamas that is sometimes not allied with Iran. And so you can see that developing. But I think what's important right now, I don't think this is the end of the Hamas Iran relationship just yet. I think it speaks to how much control Iran now has over the situation and the fight against Israel. Even if you have a Palestinian group that wants to declare peace with Israel, Iran has another Palestinian group ready to take the stand for the Islamic regime to push against Israel. And we know the Bible speaks about them wanting to do that and increase those efforts as time goes on.
Where do you send someone who wants more information, Brent?
About Iran and their desire for Jerusalem, they really need to read our editor-in-chief's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our weekend review program on 101.3 KPCG. The future of the internet is in peril after a controversial directive passed by the European Parliament. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
So the EU passed on Tuesday what's probably one of the most controversial laws that it has ever passed in its history. It was met by a whole load of protests. It was met by Change.org's largest ever petition, with 5 million people signing a petition against it. Hundreds of thousands of people across Europe that weekend protesting against it. Some of the biggest names in tech, and at least within, say, the internet, people like Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, Jimmy Wales, the founder of or co-founder of Wikipedia, they had all over the course of the debate signed letters warning about what the European Union is doing. This particular letter, it called their directive an imminent threat to the future of the internet. So a big move by the EU to try and control what is allowed to go online. Now, this directive was supposed to be about copyright. It was a copyright directive. It's easy to agree with what they were aiming to do. They wanted what they said that they were aiming to do, which was just to make sure content creators get paid for the content that they make. But the way that they put this into practice was very, very concerning, and people were worried that this basically could lead to the creation of a kind of a heavily censored and restricted version of the internet in Europe, and that if you're in the European Union, you'd only be able to access this much more locked down internet, pushing Europe in some ways on the same road on the road towards China, where they have their great firewall. So the concerning parts of this copyright directive, there was Article 11, which is the so-called link tax. And so here, this is if you quote someone else, you have to pay them money if it's more than just a few words. It's a very short snippet, I believe the directive said. Other countries have tried this. It has performed horribly. It led to Google News completely pulling out of Spain at one point. Nobody likes this. Journalists don't like it because they like their stuff being quoted and linked to. It leads to more people reading their material. But the EU has pushed ahead with this anyway. It's something that could be used to suppress free speech, because if you quote from someone in order to argue with them, the person you quote from could say, no, you can't do that. And it's probably going to push people towards a smaller number of big mainstream media websites and away from any startups, away from any smaller websites, because the big mainstream sites are kind of chummy with each other. They can easily sign just a few deals that allows them to quote from each other. The big, really concerning one is Article 13. So this applies to any website that hosts things from the public. And it says that anything on there has to be checked for copyright infringement before it goes public. So if you upload something to YouTube, YouTube has to have a system where they check the video for copyright infringement before it goes live, rather than dealing with it only if a complaint comes up later. Now, this is concerning because it basically forces all companies to create some kind of filter on what goes online. You know, there are 400 hours, I think it is, of video uploaded to YouTube every minute. There's no way that you could have people review all of these videos. You've got to have a machine that does it. So you're having some automated content filtering machine. Again, only big companies can afford to make those. So you kill all the little guys. And Europe always likes working with the big companies anyway. But then you're basically creating a filter machine. And at first, it might filter for copyright. But at the end of the day, you've built a machine for filtering things out on the internet. If Europe turns around and decides, well, you know what, we'd like to filter out hate speech, and we're going to define anything critical of the EU as automatically being hate speech, well, they've got the infrastructure then in place to enforce that. And that's why some of the, like this letter from Tim Berners-Lee, they warned that this takes an unprecedented step towards the transformation from the internet from an open platform for sharing and innovation into a tool for the automated surveillance and control of its users. European Digital Rights, they warned that this directive sets a dangerous precedent for internet filters and automatic censorship. So this is the direction Europe's pushing the internet for everybody within Europe.
This is the way Europe operates, isn't it? You would think that, I guess, in the climate of how much Europeans are wanting less Europe, and they're kind of punishing the bureaucrats, and they're saying we want more sovereignty, more independence, that these bureaucrats would be a little bit more careful about it, you know, laying down this kind of law that is certain to anger and alienate a lot of people. And yet it's almost like they can't help themselves. This their desire for control, and in this case, control over the internet, which they've never possessed to this point, to the degree that they will, this desire to regulate everything, they can't help themselves. They want the power.
That's right. And it's, you know, it's amazing the lengths that they went to, all the opposition that they went to. They're really keen on this to keep pushing for that. And even now it's coming out, it looks like they cheated to get it through the European Parliament, where the European Parliament votes with a push button system. and they just give them a list of, say, 20 things they're going to vote on today. And so they say, well, now we're holding vote one, now we're holding vote two, now we're holding vote three, and you press the button. What they did for this European directive is they changed the voting order just before the votes came, and a whole load of people didn't notice. So this European directive passed by a majority of 5 votes. 13 people have since come out and said, we were fooled by this, and they've officially had their votes changed from yes to no. But Europe has said they're not doing a revote. So it's actually not even had the support of the majority in the European Parliament, but they are able to use some procedural trickery like that to trick the MPs into voting for something that they didn't even want to pass. And you know, they didn't want to vote for it, not because they don't like the European Union, but because they're up for election in May, and they're just seeing the huge amount of anger against this law that's building in Europe.
How do you expect this to unfold, and how do you view this in terms of Bible prophecy?
Well, it's a little uncertain in terms of how it unfolds. The way European Union law works in this case is they pass a directive, and then it's up to each EU state itself to translate that directive into their own law. So some of the specifics we're not going to know until we see those laws coming out. There's still time for people to try and push back, though it would be very hard. But the important thing here is, like you said, they're pushing for control. They've already gone to great lengths to try and get control of the internet. They've shown their hand. And Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald talked about this subject earlier in the year with the big GDPR law that's responsible for all of the big pop-ups that you see all over the world. And he pointed to this prophecy in Revelation 13, the mark of the beast. And you look at what that prophecy makes clear, and it's that the beast wants to control who can buy and sell. They want a huge amount of power. They want control of commerce. And you look into, well, why they're enforcing the mark of the beast. It's for a religion. They want to control what people think, which means controlling what people say. And you know, he made the point that you look at Europe and it seems bureaucratic. It seems a mess. It seems even useless at times. But they're moving in that direction. They're already, as unthreatening as they may look, they're already taking concrete actions that can lead to that destination. So, I mean, to learn more about exactly what that mark means and how Europe's moving in that direction, you can read Mr. McDonald's article. It's called The EU and the Mark of the Beast. It was actually from November 29th, 2018. And then we've got a whole small booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that goes through exactly why the beast power in Revelation 13 refers to a coming European power, and then just what exactly that mark is.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. You can also read Richard's article on thetrumpet.com right now. From his Trumpet brief earlier this week, this article soon blocked by the EU. Find that on thetrumpet.com. Before I let you go, Richard, if you wouldn't mind, just give us a brief Brexit update.
Sure. So a couple of big pieces of news this week. One was on Wednesday, UK Prime Minister Theresa May promised that she would resign if people backed her deal. That shows, I think, the depth of the unhappiness in her leadership. If that's seen as a positive, you know, please back my deal. If you do, I'll go. A pretty sad incentive, but it definitely seems like she's on the way out. There's a general admission that Britain has no real leaders right now, and they're looking for someone else to take the helm. Then the other big development is Parliament finagled its way, despite it being pretty unconstitutional, to having a series of votes on what type of Brexit Parliament wanted. And so they were presented with a whole number of options, and then they voted. So the Parliament was asked, well, do you want a no-deal hard Brexit? The answer was no. Do you want various different varieties of soft Brexits, kind of a half and half leaving the EU? The answers were all no. Well, do you want to stay in the EU and cancel Brexit? No. Do you want to hold a second referendum on Brexit? No. So there's no majority in Parliament to do anything. And in about 25 minutes, Parliament is going to vote again on Theresa May's deal. That's going to be pretty close. If that passes, then she will resign and we should have a new prime minister by July. If it fails, everything's up in the air again, and nobody really knows what happens then. And failure does seem like the much more likely option. Potentially even fresh elections, potentially even Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, which I'm not sure how we would be able to continue operating Edstone in that kind of a circumstance. But lots of chaos and big events happening.
Not too bad for 90 seconds of update. We appreciate that very much, Richard. Well, last week, Robert Mueller released his report on his 22-month investigation into Donald Trump over Russian collusion. For some analysis, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, yeah, 2 years and $40 million later, Robert Mueller has conclusively deduced what most security experts who examined the evidence at the beginning had deduced, is that there is absolutely no proof of collusion with Russia and any member of the Donald Trump administration. This is a really good time. There's been a lot of coverage on this topic over the past week or so. A really good time to just kind of look back at how this whole thing began with something we've covered on this program a number of times over the past 22 months, with the Christopher Steele dossier, something that the Democratic National Convention had paid a British intelligence officer, a former British intelligence officer, to come up with this document of allegations of collusion between Trump and the Russian administration, none of which were verifiable, and now with the Mueller report, none of them which look like ever could be verifiable. And so we know what the Trump administration was up to now, which is nothing. We know what the Democratic National Convention was up to now, which was paying for unverified scandalous information to try to tip the results of an election. Mm-hmm. The big question, I guess, still remaining is what the world was Christopher Steele and the Russians up to? Because if there's no collusion between the Trump administration and the Russians, there's really only three logical options for what Christopher Steele did when he put together that report. The first one is he just completely lied altogether. The second one is he's passing on unverified, salacious gossip from low-level contacts he has someplace in Russia. And the third one is it was actually him who was collaborating with the inner circles of the Kremlin to put false information into the American electoral system. I've seen security analysts who've gone over his dossier and said that due to the bad grammar, the weird way it's capitalized, it does bear all the hallmarks of something that was not written by him, was written by a Russian, likely a Russian with some connection to Russian intelligence, and then passed on to him. Which then brings up the question as to what was Russia trying to accomplish with this? I think the best theory I've seen put forward by a security analyst from the Hoover Institute is that the Russians are still very upset about American criticism of their so-called managed democracy. And this was just kind of one way for them to try to make their managed democracy look better by saying that, like, okay, well, you can accuse us of election rigging and all this or whatnot, but it takes me 30 minutes on a typewriter writing up unverified allegations that I can just pass on to your opposition candidate to cost your country $40 million and 2 years of political chaos. Mm-hmm. The American political situation is just that unstable right now. And I mean, you can point fingers at Christopher Steele or the Russians, but the fact is it didn't take them a lot of work. It took him about 40 cents worth of ink and paper to cost America $40 million in finger pointing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So, yeah, what does the... it seems like that's really the big takeaway, is what this tells us about the state of America and just the divisions within the United States, that we're so susceptible and vulnerable to that type of meddling.
Right. We've brought up the scripture before that is one of our keynote prophecies in Isaiah verses 1, verses 4 through 6, where it says, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger. They have gone away backward. Why should you be stricken anymore? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores." Mm. So that's this picture God's painting of the head of Israel, the head of Israel. Now, the head of a nation is the government structure of that nation. And as we've brought out many times before, Israel, end time Israel, is primarily the United States and Britain. So this is a prophecy about the state of the American government, where when God's describing it, there's no soundness in it. It's covered with putrefying sores. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. And it takes a government system that is pretty sick and faint that someone who doesn't even work in British intelligence anymore, who knows, has some contacts in Russia, can get some paper and a typewriter, write up 40 pages of bad grammar and unverified rumors, and just throw the entire American government into a tizzy for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very shameful chapter in America's history, and it seems like the damage is really irreversible in a lot of ways. So you do have to congratulate the Russians on successfully undermining American democracy. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, India demonstrates the ability to destroy satellites in space, relations improving between China and Europe, how economic sanctions are hurting Iran, and the war that is killing 30,000 Americans every year. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
For a modern world as dependent on satellite technology as we are, this next story has troubling ramifications. Another nation demonstrating the ability to destroy satellites in space. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, India announced on Wednesday that it successfully destroyed a satellite that was orbiting the Earth. This announcement was made by the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and he said that the country used one of its indigenously designed ballistic missile interceptors for this. So the missile tore through the air for about 3 minutes, and it went about 190 miles high. And then it hit one of India's older satellites that they weren't using anymore. So this satellite was in low Earth orbit, and the missile blew it up. It was blown to pieces, and all those pieces in the debris field now are expected to fall to Earth over the next couple of weeks and months. And the real significance of this is that it means India has the capacity to knock out other countries' satellites. You know, it's proven that it can successfully target and destroy whichever targets in low Earth orbit that it would like to hit. And this puts India in a very elite club. Before Wednesday, only the United States, Russia, and China had ever demonstrated this ability to strike satellites in orbit before. So now India is added to that very short list. So it, it really showcases India's growing industrial and military strength.
So the idea that they would be able to destroy satellites, that has to be particularly concerning, especially to those countries that are as dependent on satellite technology as the United States.
Yes, which, you know, the U.S. is more dependent on satellite technology than any other nation. And the ones that India just demonstrated the ability to strike are low Earth satellites. So that's anything between 100 miles and 1,200 miles above Earth's surface. And the U.S. uses those kinds of satellites for communication, reconnaissance, and observation. They also provide vital military data for things like deploying forces in a conflict, GPS-guided battlefields. There are also smart bombs and navigation systems that, you know, tap into the data coming from these constellations of satellites. And a lot of these are just vital components of geolocation and precision technology. And it's billions of dollars worth of infrastructure also that America has up there. So this is it's a really concerning threat.
So some say that India is also sending a message to China, to Pakistan. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think right now probably the primary reason why India is increasing its military strength and demonstrating it, demonstrating specifically this anti-satellite technology, the primary reasons are because of India's tensions with China and Pakistan. Those are India's arch rivals, really. But Bible prophecy shows that in the Third World War that's just on the horizon, India will eventually align with China under Russia's leadership. And the Pakistan could very well be aligned with that bloc as well. In the September 2014 issue of The Trumpet, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, explained many details about this future Asian force. And he pointed to Revelation 16:12, which calls it the kings of the East, kings plural. He also pointed to Revelation 9:16, which says it'll have one-fifth of a billion soldiers. And then Mr. Fleury says that these two passages show that this Asian bloc will, quote, include the combined forces from several Asian nations, end quote. And then he spent some time digging into Ezekiel 38, which shows that Russia will be the lead nation in the group. But then verse 5 of Ezekiel 38 says that the peoples of Cush and Phut will also be a part of it. That's the way Young's literal translation and several other translations render those names there in verse 5. And history shows that while some parts of the peoples of Cush and Phut ended up settling in Africa, the rest migrated to India and Pakistan. So the context of this passage shows that it is referring to the modern-day Indian peoples and probably, you know, many of the modern-day Pakistanis as well. So with India now having developed this anti-satellite capability, you know, the stage is really being set for this Kings of the East superpower to be even more formidable and dangerous.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We'll put links to Russia and China in prophecy. And also, Vladimir Putin is the prophesied prince of Russia to give the prophetic overview of how India fits into what the Bible prophesies will happen in Asia. We'll put those links in our show notes for today's program. Thank you, Jeremiah. Well, we started the program by talking about a prophecy of a mart of nations aligning to undermine America's economic dominance and how Russia is part of that. And as we mentioned, China and Europe are also major components of this prophesied economic alliance. The Trumpet watches these relationships very closely. Recent developments show greater alignment between China and Europe that is going to have a real impact in this prophetically significant association. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this prophecy really took a huge step forward this week with Chinese President Xi Jinping traveling to Europe from March 23rd to March 26th. He's visited the leaders of Italy, France, and Germany with several significant events along this trip. So the first was on March 23rd. Italy became the first G7 country to sign on to China's Belt and Road Initiative. So China's going to be pouring money into Italy's ports. I think it was around $7.5 billion that they talked about in terms of deals on this trip. And China's going to really work to integrate Italy now more into their into their transportation hub. Then the next day, Xi Jinping was in Paris, and Paris wasn't signing on to the Belt and Road, but they made even more in deals with China, around $40 or $50 billion in deals. At the heart of this was a massive $35 billion contract with Airbus for 300 new airlines, which was all, that's also a big blow to Boeing. It's kind of symbolic because they'd previously bought that kind of amount from Boeing, but they were, you know, they're making a clear picture that we're switching our loyalties to the big European champion and we're avoiding the big American champion. And well, and then they went on, they visited Angela Merkel, or Xi Jinping visited Angela Merkel alongside French President Emmanuel Macron. And they really talked about kind of working together, multilateralism, how Europe and China can work together on trade and to revive world trade. And I think this whole meeting is, it really ties in really well with what the Bible says about this mart of nations. You know, we heard a bit about it from Jeremiah before, but Isaiah chapter 23 talks about a mart of nations. You look at who it's referring to in Bible prophecy. It's talking about European powers. It's talking about China. It's talking about Japan. And it's talking about this being an economic alliance. It's talking about this being involving traders and merchants. And you can look at other scriptures and see that this economic alliance works together to shut out the United States. And we see them building an economic alliance. But at the same time, the Bible makes clear that this Mart of Nations is not a hugely long-lasting meeting of minds, incredibly friendly partnership. They work together because they have a common interest. They work together because they're both working against the United States. They don't see eye to eye on everything. And you see this in Europe's relationship with China right now. Yes, they're very happy to do these deals with China. Yes, they're very happy to even talk about working with China and creating a new trade system, even talking about kind of excluding the United States. Both of these nations are under the threat of trade sanctions, or powers are under the threat of trade sanctions from the United States. But at the same time, for the first time ever, just a few days ago on March 12th, the EU officially labeled China an economic competitor. They're having a lot of these debates about, are we drawing too close to China? So yes, they're making these deals, but at the same time, they have those reservations and they see that it's not a long-term alliance, which is exactly the relationship described in the Bible.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. We will have an article up on the website on thetrumpet.com on Monday on this subject. So please do keep your eyes peeled for that. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. America has reimposed economic sanctions on Iran, and indications are they're having an effect. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece that came out in the New York Times this week, and it was entitled, As U.S. Tightens Iran Sanctions, Militant Groups and Political Allies Feel the Pain. And it describes some interesting comments that were given to this reporter regarding the proxies that Iran uses, mainly in the war in Syria. And it talks about how that the funds are starting to run dry. A lot of the Shiite proxies that it uses there are only getting about half the pay that they got a couple of years ago. Even Hezbollah is saying that they are running dry on some funds. Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah that is working right now inside Syria and also southern Lebanon, he has directed the fundraising efforts to increase so that they continue to function in that capacity. And so all this is coming on because the United States has enacted some really strict financial sanctions on the Iranian regime. I was up in the Golan Heights actually this week, and I was talking to an Israeli security analyst, and he was talking about how that these sanctions are already taking effect, especially in Iran's ability to maintain the ground fighting force that it has inside Syria. Now, in Syria, it's very interesting because you don't have the demographics that you have in Iraq or Lebanon. Syria is a majority Sunni state, and the proxies that Iran is paying belong to the Shia sect. And so it needs to pay more people in Syria to fight its war than it does so in southern Lebanon and in Iraq. Iraq, Iran doesn't have to pay for them. The Iraqi Shiite militias, they are part of the official government right now, so they get paid out of the Iraqi government coffers. So it can maintain its influence in Iraq without the financial backing, without the finances, but it cannot do that inside Syria. Because right now you've got tens of thousands of Pakistani and Afghani Shiites that have been shipped there to fight for Iran. And those people are starting to run out of money.
So possible that these sanctions may end up hastening this division between Syria and Iran that we've been expecting.
It is really interesting, isn't it? Just because we have expected this divorce for a long time inside Syria with Iran's ability to continue to control the Syrian regime, and yet we talk about Iran marching across the Middle East, being able to demonstrate its power and push at other nations. But if you look at this precise moment, as we've been reporting on for the past month or so, it looks like Iran believes Iraq is in the bag. They're wedded together. And so financial sanctions won't impact that relationship. And we know Bible prophecy talks about Iraq and Iran staying together. But it does talk about Syria falling out of Iran's sway. And I asked this security analyst up on the Golan Heights, I said, is there any possibility that because of these strict sanctions on Iran right now, that it will have an effect or at least partially motivate Iran's withdrawal from Syria, as well as the pressure that they could get from the Russians and such? And he said, yes, it's already starting to happen, he said. And so while we're not saying that, you know, Israel is out of danger here because of, you know, Iranian proxies on their border in the Golan Heights or even in southern Lebanon, it looks like Iran doesn't have the money to continue to have the ground force inside Syria. And of course, the Bible talks about a break between Iran and Syria that's found in Psalm 83. There is an alliance that Syria is a part of called the Psalm 83, that we call the Psalm 83 alliance, that Iran does not lead. This is an alliance that is made up of nations, Arab nations, and a united Europe that doesn't answer to Iran, that is actually, in the end, going to be a counter-Iran alliance. And so it's interesting, the increasing financial pressure of the United States, you could say, oh, it's not going to have an effect. Look at the prophecies of Iran's rise. But then look here, it might have an effect at drawing down Iran's forces inside Syria, bringing about this prophecy.
Hmm. Thank you very much. Very fascinating stuff. We appreciate that, Brent. We're going to finish quickly with this story about a war that is killing 30,000 Americans per year. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, synthetic drugs from China are changing the structure of the illegal drug market. Just for the year latest statistics are available, 2017, there was a full 28,000 people, 28,000 Americans who died from fentanyl poisoning. That's a synthetic drug meant to mimic the effects of heroin, but 50 times more potent. And so not only is this leading to a huge death wave in America, it's also restructuring the entire way the illegal drug market works. For decades, you've had these Mexican drug lords like Joaquin Guzman, who've reigned almost like feudal lords in Mexico, with thousands of Mexican peasants farming poppy fields of poppy flowers, and then their own chemical labs to where they harvest the opium paste for those poppy flowers to distill it into heroin, and their own distribution networks bringing it into the United States. And it was all a big operation, required a big cartel like the Sinaloa cartel. Now that you can get something 50 times more potent, produces the same effect, and have it brought in for cheap on a boat from China, a lot of this production is, like so many other jobs around the world, being outsourced from Mexico to China. Mm. And it makes it much easier for smaller cartels with someone with a laptop order and a gang to order some mail stuff from China and then trafficking it into the United States. It's having a huge effect in Mexico as these smaller cartels fight with each other. The death toll's gone way up from the days when the big cartels dominated huge regions. So yeah, the homicide toll in Mexico has gone way up, similar to the way the overdose toll in America has gone way up. And there's been a number of security analysis talking about how there probably won't be another Shorty Guzman. There won't be another huge drug kingpin as the market fragments and the smaller cartels start operating. Although I think I could almost go a step further and say that Xi Jinping is the new Joaquin Guzman. In that he has some plausible deniability, as you can blame corrupt local officials in China for sending this stuff to Mexico. But when you run a communist dictatorship, the law is what you say it is. And so no serious security analyst doesn't believe that Xi Jinping couldn't stop the flow of fentanyl into America. Could do it in a week if he felt like it.
Right. Well, it's in a way, it's it's the same story that we were talking about at the end of the first segment, where Americans are kind of doing this to ourselves, that you have a foreign agent who is exploiting the weakness of the people and using that against ourselves.
Right. The demand's there. I mean, it's you've got the demand for a heroin like drug is in the American. There's about 600,000 heroin addicts in America, and some of them use some of them go for misusing legal pharmaceuticals they can buy legally from the American pharmaceutical industry. Some of them turn to Mexican poppy farmers. Increasingly, the new drug of choice is fentanyl from China. And the Chinese have played this a little different. The Mexican drug cartels were mostly in it for the money. I don't think the Chinese care as much about the money as they care about undermining a rival on the international scene. But like you said, it is very similar with both Russia's steel dossier and China's fentanyl. It's something that both powers can use to undermine America for cheap because of the sins of the American people.
Well, if you'd like more information about that, Andrew actually wrote an article in our October 2018 print edition called China's Drug War Against America. Excellent article in that print edition. Go check that out. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and you can find links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Honored to be here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Pearl Buck. The secret of joy in work is contained in one word, excellence. To know how to do something well is to enjoy it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.